Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Go to Dutch.com to get vet care that is always there for just $92 a year. Here's something most people don't realize. Great sleep doesn't happen by accident. It starts with what you're sleeping on. That's why I switched to Sheiks. Their bedding is made from the same performance fabrics you'd find in elite athletic wear, but designed to help you sleep better. If you run hot at night, these sheets help you stay cool and dry. If you love that cozy, ridiculously soft feel, they've got that too. Comfort that stays consistent from the moment you hop into bed. And for anyone with an adjustable base, this is a game changer. Their Stay Fit corners are the best I've ever tried. No slipping, no popping off, even when the bed moves. When your days are demanding, Sheiks helps you wake up restored, not run down. Try them for yourself with their 60-night risk-free guarantee. Upgrade your sleep at Sheiks.com.
One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I am your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today, friends, is one of our favorite authors, film critics, and podcasters. Her writing has appeared at The Wrap, IndieWire, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, MTV, Turner Classic Movies, and her site, The Film Maven. She's also the host and producer of the podcast Ticklish Business. We last spoke to her on the publication of her book, But Have You Read the Book? 52 Literary Gems That Inspired Our Favorite Movies. And here's a fun tidbit. Its sequel will be out later this year. In the meantime, her most recent book, Popcorn Disability, was released late last year. And somehow, she has a whole-ass other book, Welcome, Boils and Ghouls, The Complete Oral History of Tales from the Crypt, on deck for publication in 2027. Folks, please welcome the insightful, the delightful, the incredibly prolific Kristen Lopez. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. With that bio, I sound like the Jude Law of publishing.
You are... I am like, I consider myself, like, I feel like I've written a lot of books, and then I'm looking at this, and I'm like, I gotta pick my game up. Kristen is smoking me out on the field.
I've pretty much said, like, if I ever write another book, it'll be a miracle, because writing three in, like, 3 years?
Yeah.
No, I don't advocate it for anybody. If anybody is like, this is a great idea, actually, no, it's a terrible idea. Don't ever do it.
I mean, there are worse problems to have. But I feel you. That is a lot of work. And especially as sort of as deeply researched as these books are, as thoughtful and analytical as they are, you are not someone who's just like tossing them off, you know, for Amazon self-publishing purposes. You're like doing the work. And so bravo for that.
It's always nice to see a book that is not heavily researched that just like ends up on Fox News or something, and I'm just like, how do I have to do all the research? And these people just publish swill that's just like, I thought these things and I put them on a page.
Yes. You
and
just
they're number
you
one.
You just need a right-wing think tank to like your work and buy it in bulk so it's a bestseller. That said, I know you've been promoting it for months, but we do want to do some plugging for those who haven't read it yet. Tell us about Popcorn Disability. What is it about? How is it about it?
Yeah, bless you for thinking I've been promoting it this whole time. it's been a challenge. Disability is not a sexy topic. You know, they're not putting it on the morning shows or anything. So sure, like promotion is just kind of like kind people like yourselves who have a podcast and want me to yak about it. But no, I mean, you know, when people ask me like why I decided to write the book, it's usually my not so joking thing is like my agent thought I should write another book like now. So, you know, and at the time I had a full-time job, so it wasn't like the first book where there was a pandemic, so I had nothing but time to work and write a book. And, you know, I had a couple ideas that hadn't sold. I was starting to get a little discouraged that maybe, like, I shouldn't be writing any more books. So I kind of went back to what I knew. I was like, what can I write that I know really well so that I can work and also write this book? And I know where the research is. I know what I want to do. And I was like, well, you know, I'll write a disability and film book. And worst case scenario, it'll be an opportunity for all of the writing that I've done over the years, you know, whether it's for your site, Jason, or for everybody else. I can take all the terminology and all of those kind of thoughts that I've conjured up, and at least I'll have a book that I can kind of say, like, here, all of my thoughts on disability and film are here. And as I started writing it, you know, the way that I had pitched it to the publisher was I didn't want to write another academic tome, you know, like these are the stereotypes and these are why they're bad and all of these things. I wanted to do something a little bit different. I wanted to make it funny. I wanted to make it snarky. You know, the fact that I am a film critic and I am an entertainment journalist, I kind of understand the both sides-ism of the whole thing. And I also really wanted to talk about how a generation of watching these movies, how they've made me, you know, how watching these movies made me feel about myself. And I'm sure a whole generation of other people. And, you know, the bigger, you know, what does it all mean thing is like how bad representation, unfortunately, creates a generation of disabled people that have grown up with a lot of self-loathing. And all of that was really depressing when I kind of tried to sell it. But as I was writing it, you know, it was kind of cathartic to kind of be like, oh, you know, I'm a woman and I'm, you know, a disabled person. So, like, of course I'm supposed to feel like shit about myself, you know, like, it's a double-edged sword. I got to watch a lot of movies that I had been recommended over the years that I had not wanted to watch. So there were days where I was just like starting to look at Friends like askance, like, I don't know how I feel about you liking this movie. You know, I got to poke some loving fun at some things that I love. You know, it was worth the journey, you know, at the end of the day. So now when people are like, you know, I love Mask. Isn't that movie great? I can be like, oh, here's this chapter that I wrote about how, you know, I think Peter Bogdanovich and I would not have gotten along if we had talked about it.
Yeah. Yeah. You get to just respond by saying, I have thoughts. So I don't know about you. For me, the difficult thing about writing a book about kind of a big topic is that then you feel like, for me, now every time a great New York movie comes out, I'm like mad that I didn't get to put it into the book. I feel like you're probably already having some, I mean, Kate Hudson did just get her Oscar nomination, and I know you're I'm sure sorely disappointed you weren't able to get Song Sung Blue into the book.
Yeah, that's the one that I keep being like, God, if the publisher ever thinks that they've sold enough copies and wants like another one.
Second edition, paperback.
I would love to put that in there. I'd also love to put the Creed films in there because I did genuinely forget them. And I felt so terrible that I was like, no, I had an opportunity to like celebrate Tessa Thompson. So there are some things that I would love to include. Like now that when I was writing it, Snow White was not out yet. And Wicked for Good was not out yet. So I kind of had some like long lead theories, but I've seen them now and I would love to just add some stuff. And I keep getting recommendations for like older films, and I'm discovering things that I didn't include the first go round where I'm just kind of, and that's why I'm like, that's why I have the Popcorn Disabilities column on the Film Maven to kind of talk about some of the movies that I know will inevitably pop up, that I'm sure, I did get to write about Cripping Up, and Kate Hudson. I mean, it was a whole thing. The whole Song Sung Blue thing kind of culminated with Craig Brewer realizing that I did not like the movie, but I don't believe he knows why. I think he stumbled upon a tweet that I had wrote about how I didn't like it. But I'm not clear that he's aware of why I don't like it. So, you know, these are things that like Volume 2 would love to sit down with Craig Brewer and be like, why?
Let's talk about it.
Let's have an honest conversation.
Let's have a
about
talk about
what's
it.
Going on there and what you've learned now about ableism and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we will look forward to that. We will look forward to volume two. I heartily recommend the book. It's really thoughtful. It's well written. It will make you see movies you have seen maybe a lot of times in new and interesting ways. And I always appreciate that. And then, as we said, but Have You Read the Book sequel is out later this year. Congratulations on that. And then you were in process when we had you on A Very Good Year, you were working on the Tales from the Crypt book. So that is now is that put to bed? Is it still in edits? What's going on with that one?
We're in edits right now. It's a little long.
Sure.
So my publisher would only like another 50,000 words cut. I gave him a 650 page manuscript with everything in it. So I have some cuts. I have some darlings to kill, but
yeah.
We are inching ever closer to it. Yeah. And I'm already kind of putting the cart before the horse. There's a lot of LA events I'd love to do. That's, I would love to keep manifesting to the Tales from the Crypt gods, i.e. the Donner Company, to, get the series back out, so that, when the book is out, people can actually watch some of these episodes. But yeah, we're inching ever closer. August 3rd, 2027 is what they're hoping for. And this year, this June though, does mark the 30th anniversary of when the series ended. So, I'm going to try to keep the book in the public eye.
Never too soon to start promoting, never too late to keep promoting. And I would like to say, as we know, representation matters. And on behalf of all of the people who write way too long first drafts, I appreciate your representation on this particular matter. Okay.
I keep telling my publisher, I'm like, well, what did you want me to do? I'd rather give you too much than not enough. So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's the lie I keep telling my editors as well. Okay. So what film, Kristen Lopez, did you select from Danny Perry's Guide for the Film Fanatic to discuss with us today?
I picked something that was neither disabled-centric nor Tales from the Crypt-centric, although I would have loved it if Robert Plant had done an episode of Tales from the Crypt. Roger Daltrey did, but not him. I picked 1976's Led Zeppelin, The Song Remains the Same.
There's your Zepp font coming out strong with a font heavy trailer.
And then, a guy on a bike. What?
Sure. Sure. I mean, what is the first thing you visualize when you hear the music of Led Zeppelin? For me,
rock and roll and a great fall foliage, fall day.
If there's one thing that Zeppelin's music says to me, it's cozy. It's cozy, wintry, rustic. And then there's also gangsters for some reason. And credit where due. They are not hiding what the movie is from you. It's these guys. They're rock stars. They're going to be on stage singing songs. This part more accurately, I think, represents.
I love that the narrator sounds like you're going to watch a movie about lovable scamps.
I mean, maybe at the time people thought that before the books started coming out.
Right.
Did you know that they rebuilt the Madison Square Garden?
Hey! I have a whole segment. I have a whole segment where I say that stuff. Why are you stepping on my juice here, buddy?
I'm saying I didn't. It was well done. I guess is what I'm saying, because I genuinely had no idea that they did any of that. Even though I noticed all the weird things about it, the wig, how can you not notice the wig? But maybe it was just a joke that I'm not in on. Blah blah. I don't know.
That's
what I mean?
Always a possibility with a rock star movie.
Right.
It's true. No, there were apparently, because they recorded multiple nights at MSG even, where they had continuity errors where some of the members of the band knew that they were supposed to wear the same clothes and some didn't, and somehow there was no one double checking that before they all went on stage, which I actually don't blame the musicians for that. That is not their job. They're there to bang drums or play a bass. Someone needs to tell them, no, wear this again tomorrow. No, don't get your hair cut before we reshoot. You'll have to wear a wig. It'll be super silly.
You want me to be sober enough to keep track of my headbands?
The scenes on stage, I'm not believing Rob Reiner when he said he didn't take inspo from anybody.
Oh.
Because I feel he took a lot of inspo from...
Oh, that's a specific note. That's, yeah, we'll discuss. I mean, like, there is so much of this movie in Spinal Tap. There is, like... This is, I mean, this is...
I'm waiting for Stonehenge to pop up.
Right.
Like, that, it would make so much sense.
This is, like, borderline, like, the correlation between this and Spinal Tap is, like, the correlation between Airport and Airplane. I mean, that's a pretty direct...
Can we talk about how this was a three-minute trailer that had, like, maybe a minute and a half of music and then, like, a bunch of divergences? And it was rated PG!
And it was somehow rated PG. Yeah, I love that, too. Okay, so... The Song Remains the Same is a primarily concert documentary starring British rock legends Led Zeppelin. Its concert footage was primarily shot during a three-night stint at Madison Square Garden in late July of 1973 by director Joe Massot. I hope I'm saying that correctly. A diligent host would have looked that up. His only previous film of note was the 1968 film Wonderwall, whose score by George Harrison was that Beatles' first solo project. The band and manager Peter Grant, quite a presence in the picture, were unhappy with the results, so they sacked Massot and brought on Australian director Peter Clifton, who shot the fantasy accompaniment sequences, as well as reshooting the full concert on a replica of the MSG stage recreated at Shepperton Studios in August 1974. The film was finally released 18 months behind schedule and well over budget in October of 1976. All right, Mike, what does Danny Perry say about The Song Remains the Same in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Got a little bit of lemon in my mouth. Okay, deadening documentary.
Deadening documentary. First two words.
That's a wild start.
Sure is.
Deadening documentary of legendary defunct British supergroup Led Zeppelin, the most influential perpetrator of the heavy metal sound. Directors Peter Clifton and Joe Massot juxtapose footage from a 1973 concert in Madison Square Garden, ridiculous Spinal Tap-like backstage glimpses, incomprehensible chatter, the roadie manager telling off MSG officials for allowing the sale of Zeppelin merchandise in the building, newspaper headlines stating that the group had more than $200,000 stolen from the hotel strongbox, and pretentious fantasy sequences featuring each member of the group. Ex-Yardbird Jimmy Page has a couple of inspired guitar breaks, and John Bonham has a nifty drum solo, during which he puts down his sticks and slaps his cymbals with his hands. Meanwhile, we see shots of him and his wife and children at home and feel sad, knowing that he'd die of asphyxiation in 1980 while on a drunken binge.
Just throwing that in.
Tell me what you really feel.
I've always hated Robert Plant singing.
So there's that. There's that.
As Zeppelin's lead singer now and as Zeppelin's lead, I've always hated Robert Plant's singing as Zeppelin's lead singer and now during his solo career. So I find it nearly impossible to withstand his singing number after number in this film. And I'm not crazy about watching him strut around Roger Daltrey style with bare belly and chest. Bassist John Paul Jones stands in the background and is inoffensive. Group does many of its big hits, including Whole Lotta Love and its signature tune Stairway to Heaven. Slow numbers never end, fast songs all sound the same, but fans and audience are mesmerized. A midnight cult hit because teenagers have joined Led Zeppelin legions.
Okay, so as we know, sometimes Mr. Perry puts he'll put the movie in the book, but he doesn't have to like it. So he's not a fan of this one.
But he doesn't always sound like a cranky old dude who's like, turn down your music, you fucking kids. Like, he kind of sounds like a cranky old guy in that.
There
is
a little bit of Get Off My Lawn in that particular capsule review.
It's a little Clint Eastwood right there.
There you go. There you go. So we will return perhaps to some of his points and agree or disagree. But I want to start, Kristen, by saying, you sent a list, and a lot of folks do this. They'll send, because it is overwhelming to look at the Guide for the Film Fanatic list. A lot of folks will send, you know, five or six and just say any of these would be cool. And then you sort of let us pick. This list had everything from film noir to like 80s comedies. And then this, which was really an outlier on that list, which was why I sort of gravitated towards it. So I want to start there. Why this movie? What is so special about this movie for you? What made you want to spend this kind of time talking about it?
Yeah, I mean, I could be crass and just be all Robert Plant's pants for 2 hours is definitely an enticement, but
they've got a worn-in cock pocket. I mean, that's pretty amazing to know that he's a left side guy.
There are scenes where the camera is like 40 yards away, practically in the middle of the crowd, and you're just like, wow. They've shown this at the Academy Museum, and I've been very upset to miss it, because I would just love to watch people be shocked for the first time. Like, it's in the trailer too. Yeah. I mean, I'm not really clear how that was missed.
Yeah.
I watched this during, I mean, I'm a music person. I've gone through my 70s rock thing. I love The Who and Zeppelin equally. I love that the rock star men of the 70s, like, they just went for, like, borrowing their girlfriend's sweaters, doing their hair up.
Sure.
I kind of miss that. Like,
sure.
they were flirting with, like, their men, but they're just really into, like, the feminine side,
sure.
But not in an androgynous way.
Mm-hmm.
I not to sound again like an old person, our guide here, but you know, I'm like, what are the BTS guys doing differently? Like, all the dudes these days are just like mid. But I saw this during the pandemic.
Okay.
I had never seen it before, and I watched it. TCM, I think, was doing like an ode to rock docs, and I remember just sitting there being, like, mesmerized for 2.5 hours, partly because of the pants, but also just because of how overwrought and opulent the movie, like, it's so self-indulgent that you're just, like, I feel like people would watch this and be like, this is what the 70s was.
Mm.
Like, everybody had great hair. They were showing up half naked and just gyrating for 2 hours. But then they also wanted to make art. They also wanted to, like, make their own little stories. And I think that's what I appreciated about it. It's all of the things of the 70s that I've read about, you know, encapsulated in one film.
Mm-hmm.
And it emphasizes to the audience why Zeppelin was so all-encompassing. You know, why you can say they're overrated, sure, okay? Why you could also say they're musical geniuses.
Mm.
Why you could say Robert Plant is, like, the hottest man in the world. You know, men, what are you doing to look like Robert Plant? You know, all of it. I literally sat there for 2.5 hours. Like, I was like, I've never taken drugs before, but I feel like this is the moment when people drop acid and they were listening to The Doors. Like, this.
Yeah.
This is that moment.
Okay. Okay. So this is great because we have extreme personal history variances here. This, for you, this was maybe, I should add, when people send us the list, sometimes I will just gravitate towards the one that I haven't seen. Because, like, oh, this is for work. It's an excuse to see the thing I haven't seen. I had never seen this movie. My history with Zeppelin is complicated. I got into them very late when I was, like, in high school. We're going to return to Wichita High School North in a moment. I know. Stand by, Mike. But when I was in high school, this was the favorite band of the people whose musical tastes I disliked the most. Some of whom were good friends of mine. And we would have, like, long arguments about, like, the relative worth of Led Zeppelin versus James Brown. And you know what? We were both being dicks about it. I should have listened to Led Zeppelin. Aaron Randall should have listened to James Brown. We both would have matured much more quickly. But as a result, Zepp was always this sort of, like, not even as a, I don't know that I'd heard more than, like, Stairway to Heaven and three other things, but they were just symbolic of a thing that I didn't like. I finally came around to them late 20s, I want to say, and was like, oh, this is actually great. Derp. You know, there's a reason that they were a giant sensation, music changing band, et cetera, et cetera. But even within that, I will say, I really like the first four albums, and I think the ones after that are not as good and are a little self-indulgent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But I had never seen this movie, and I had always heard, oh, it's bloated, it's pretentious, it's yada yada, you know. And so it was not like top of mind to see, but again, wanted to see it, wanted to see what it was all about. So yes, put it on the other night. Had a couple gummies at the beginning of it and enjoyed it just fine. Enjoyed a lot of it. Had some criticisms, which we'll get into later. Okay, now for the polar opposite. Mike Hull, what is your personal experience with Led Zeppelin as a band and with their concert film, The Song Remains the Same?
I mean, I'm born in 1976, so mm-hmm. like... I may have been conceived
for
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, you're like, and you are as old as this film. Like, you're exactly as old as this film. Congratulations.
And like, thanks. It's great. It's aging better than I am. it's like my parents listened to Led Zeppelin all the time.
Sure.
And like, you know, Rush and all of that, like sure. all that stuff. I mean, they were playing all that stuff my whole life growing up. And then in the 90s, I spent most of my free time smoking pot in basements somewhere. And, you know, the VHS of this mm-hmm. was a perpetual, I mean, mm-hmm. forever. Like, how many times have I fucking watched this movie on acid? I have mm-hmm. no idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, was I watching? Some of the time, you know what I mean? So like, this is one of these things where like, this just feels, I can smell this movie. It smells like Zigzag Rolling Papers. You know, I mean, I had it on when we logged on to this thing and Jason was like, oh no, have you not finished it yet? And I was like, this time, I mean, so it's just one of these things where like, this feels like a family reunion or something. I don't even know. Like, you know, I can't conceive of life without Led Zeppelin being a part of it. Even though I haven't like intentionally said like, I'm going to go listen to Led Zeppelin in a long time.
Right.
But also right. I live in America. They're around. You hear it all. You know what I mean? You just hear the music. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Do you hear a 30-minute version of Dazed and Confused? Not necessarily.
Right.
That's why you got to go to the movie sometimes.
Right.
You know?
Right. So in that... At that point in your life, at that and in that specific consciousness, I mean, what did you think of it then as a movie, as cinema, and how does that contrast with your feelings about it now?
If at all. Well, they always sort of felt like the kids that like didn't do any of the homework but always passed the test. You know what I mean? Like, they always felt like they always feel kind of sloppy to me, just like uh-huh. listening to the music. And the live right. performance is much more even than the studio stuff. You know, it's clear that they're all super talented, but it also just sort of seems like they're not trying very hard. And like, you know, why does nobody talk about John Paul Jones? Because he had his career at the same time as Bootsy Collins. And get the fuck right. out of here. If you're going to talk about a bass player from right. 1973, who are you going to talk about, right?
Sure.
But then you watch the 30-minute version of Dazed and Confused. And I mean, those guitars, she's soloing for 20 minutes of that shit. And it's all tight as a drum, dude. It's all so good. And right. like, so it's sort of one of those things where, you know, you feel like they get all this stuff without trying that hard. And then they're like, oh, is that what you think? Oh, here, you know, sort of watch this.
Right.
You know, how can is the drum solo too long? I don't know, motherfucker. It's interesting the entire time. How long can you keep people interested with two sticks and a handful of tom-toms? I think I might have 30 to 45 seconds before people swipe.
Right.
If it's swiping, my 3 to 4 seconds, right? So
right.
like, it's always one of those things where every time you sort of, you sort of can have opinions about them until you come back to it.
Yeah.
Now, as cinema, you know, I mean, I think but that's also infected by what I've learned since then, which is, you know, Jimmy Page goes and buys Aleister Crowley's old house, you know, and he's
right.
doing sex magic. And or is he? Or is that just an excuse
right.
to fuck hippie girls? I don't know. I mean, right. So, like, you know all of that stuff now. And, like, yeah. in a way, the movies kind of make more sense when you, like, know that stuff about them. Mm-hmm. You know, they like, they were heavily into symbols. You know, I mean, you know, they all had symbols for themselves. Right. But, like, just the symbology, all the stuff that's sewn on his dragon suits and all that shit. Like, all of that is sort of meaningful and to them. And once you reach a point where, like, you can actually make that your life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can't be expected to adhere to whatever the rest of us think is rational.
I mean, to go off of that, I think there's an allure that the movie simultaneously wants to play into and deconstruct at the same time. And it doesn't really understand what to do with either of those things. I mean, you know, it's kind of remarkable to think that Led Zeppelin didn't have a movie like right out the gate.
Right.
You know,
right.
Gimme Shelter had come out, you know, earlier in the 70s. And that's kind of the de facto to most people, you know, Rolling Stones story. You know, the Who had done a lot of like recorded stuff. I don't think anything that went to theaters, but, you know, they had the Ken Russell films.
Last Waltz. When was that? That was
Last Waltz was after this. That was 78 was when that came out.
Oh, okay.
Out. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But Beatles had Let It Be out in 1970, you know, yeah.
Yeah, they had Hard Day's Night. They were already kind of spoofing themselves. So they were already well over in film. And, you know, to realize that they started this in 73, they finished this in 76. And I think by that point, Zeppelin was already at its peak.
Right.
And there was like really nowhere to go but down.
Right.
You know, I grew up as a kid that was raised by Cameron Crowe movies, specifically Almost Famous. Almost Famous is the movie I always tell people.
Totally.
It's why it's my personality very much. It's why I became a writer.
Totally.
All of it.
Totally.
And, you know, I went deep into like reading about the groupie lifestyle, reading Pamela Desbar's books. You know, and you kind of create this cult of like what the 70s rock star looks like. And you watch the majority of the song remains the same. And you're like, this is exactly, I understand as a 17-year-old girl at the time, you know, why 17-year-old girls were probably doing God knows what, you know, to get backstage.
Right.
I get it. You know, whatever. But at the same time, the movie understands that and lets them kind of do whatever they want. But then it tries to like cut to these moments behind the scenes. And what's bizarre is that there's really only like one scene of them unscripted in the behind the stage areas. It's not mixed very well, so you can't really hear what everybody's saying. Mm-hmm. Thank God for subtitles. And the majority of it is just like Peter Grant doing stuff behind the scenes, whether that's yelling at the promoter or the whole thing with the thievery. So the movie wants to say like, this is Zeppelin, you know, uncensored, like these are the real people. But I'm not buying that Robert Plant's hanging out in the idyllic like woods of, I don't know, Narnia or something with his children and his hot wife, like just chilling on a Sunday. They get like the news via post. It's practically like a guy on a horse, like delivering them tour dates. And it's just like, well, I guess we're going on tour tomorrow. So it doesn't, I know that they said that the band had, Peter Grant had a lot of say in the movie. The band had a lot of say in the movie, and Massock got fired. And, you know, he pretty much has some great one-liners about being fired from the movie. But I don't really think anybody knew what the movie wanted to be. And everybody else had already done different things with the documentary genre.
Right.
So what do you do when you don't know what you want and you don't want to be like everyone else?
This should have been Stanley Kubrick's concert movie. Because like what other band could possibly like be big enough and sort of important enough for him to do? But also who else could possibly have sort of understood how weird these guys were in a way that was useful, you know what I mean? Like in a way that's like, you know, cause all that stuff that they were attracted to. I mean, I knew people in the '80s that still had wizard robes and stuff like that, you know, like there was a people, I mean, they weren't the only ones, right?
Yeah.
There was a sort of community about that, but I don't think even they understood why necessarily they were attracted to that. You know what I mean? I think that it would have taken somebody smarter than the I didn't meet these guys. I'm not trying to call them dumb, but you know what I mean? Right. There's only a handful of people that are really sort of working on a level that can possibly synthesize all these weird things into a piece of art that moves them somewhere, or that somehow rises above or becomes more than the sum of its parts.
You raise a really interesting point that it's synthesizing elements that are kind of wildly disparate. Like, you have the concert movie, and for some people, like, that's enough. And then you also have the sort of attempt to be the kind of backstage verite, gimme shelter, you know, especially again, the stuff with Peter Grant and all, you know, and the him, you know, throwing things around and clearly inspiring Spinal Tap's manager and so forth. But then you also have, oh, hey, everybody, you get to go off and make a little home movie that's, you know, whatever fantasy, whatever, you know, drug-induced fantasy life you have about yourself. And for some of you, it'll be wizards. And for Peter Grant, it'll be a gangster somehow. Like, and so I think it could have been two of those three things. But when you try to do all three of them, it is a very sort of discombobulating, channel surfing sort of experience, maybe.
It really is. I mean, I've read different reasoning behind why each of them gets a storyline. You know, I've heard from some that, you know, they were trying to see if maybe there was desire to, like, maybe spin off into acting in some way, you know, and that this was kind of decision to see if they wanted to do it. I've heard others say that, like, they just kind of told them, like, go make something, get out of the way while we make the actual movie.
Right.
You know, all of that is whatever. I mean, I definitely think it is funny to try to kind of do the deep film critic thing of, like, what does it mean? What does it mean when Robert Plant is dressed up as a Viking? And,
you know, I don't think we have to do that. I think we all know that he just thought it would look cool.
He just thinks, and that's kind of the thing that I appreciate the movie. It's just is just clearly the shit that they think is cool, and they really think that they're making art.
Yes.
With a capital A.
Yes.
You know? Yes. But I think for me, what's always funny, and again, I think Spinal Tap really did, if anything, give this movie a second win. Like, I will show this to people with Spinal Tap and just be like,
no, good double.
You appreciate this a lot more.
Good double.
Once you see Spinal Tap, because to watch, you know, A, Harry Shearer with the cucumber in his pants going through TSA, and you're watching Robert Plant, you're like, oh, okay, I get that.
Yep.
You know, but even just some of the, like, the lackadaisical things of watching Zeppelin, like, you're watching John Bonham play, and he's just, like, making faces and, like, having some sort of weird, like, psychic conversation with John Paul Jones, and they're, like, clearly, like, looking at each other, and you're like, what is being said here?
Right.
Like, they're clearly not focused on whatever it is they're supposed to be doing, and which is rather, like, have a chat.
Right.
You know, Robert Plant's, like, hanging out on the sidelines smoking a cigarette, and, well, you know, Jimmy Page is, like, playing for 35 minutes sweating. I think, too, you know, I do wonder how much, and I don't want to give people too much credit where it's undeserved, but how much this is trying to be an anti-documentary. You know, there's no crowd shots.
Right.
Like, you maybe get one or two really weirdly, like, constructed scenes of two women just, like, watching. I do love the one woman that's, like, clearly, like, really happy to be there, and her boyfriend's looking at her like, what is going on? I have just lost my wife. Okay.
Right.
You know, there's no crowd shots. There's the behind the scenes stuff is really weirdly focused on, like, they're talking to, like, the security guards.
Right.
It's kind of like, did they not have access? I'm not really clear. And it doesn't really give an air of mystique in a lot of these sequences. It's more like ineptitude. And you have to wonder how much of that is just because these guys knew they had to do something. They knew they had to film it, and they were just like, yeah, but we don't really want to do the conventional thing.
Right.
So, like, figure that part out.
Right. Well, one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this movie is because we haven't ever done a concert film as the topic of guide for the Film Fanatic. And I could only think of one time that we had one as someone's top five which was when Jordan Hoffman picked the Grateful Dead movie for 1977. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some really fascinating conversations happening between these two movies as well, because that's also a movie that was in post-production forever, and by the time it came out, the band was a completely different version of itself. A lot of the, like, security guard and merch stuff and, like, a lot of similar kind of behind-the-scenes footage in both of those movies. But weirdly, like, one's not inspiring the other. They're both being made and being taken forever to be made at basically the same time. So that is a combination that I thought was really unusual. Talk to me then, since, you know, we clearly have said our piece about the non-musical stuff. I will, like, a lot of the concert footage here is pretty fucking spectacular, both in terms of the musicianship, but I also really, like, I think they found some interesting ways to shoot a band on stage, which is something that is not easy to do. Number one, because it can just be boring to look at, but also because, like you said, Kristen, a million people have been here before and done this a million times. But, like, you know, that home stretch of Stairway to Heaven when they're doing that split image mirror thing, like, that's awesome. That's super cool. A lot of the split screen work that they're doing throughout is really impeccable. I wanted to give you both a chance to sort of speak to it as a music documentary, aside from all of the artsy fartsy shit that they wanted to do.
You know, it's funny because I'm interested to know who kind of decided on the editing and the psychedelia, because it's kind of inconsistently mm-hmm. utilized. It's mm-hmm. more and towards the back half mm-hmm. of the movie, which makes me wonder mm-hmm. if, like, Peter Clifton came in and was like, I'm going to do all of this
right.
psychedelia stuff right. because people are going to be high off their ass and they're going to need something to look at. I think for me, you know, again, kind of coming at it from the post almost famous kind of 70s music revival of the 2000s that we were getting, you know, I think, you know, I had parents that grew up, you know, on 70s music. So for me, you know, I kind of was like, I thought much like Almost Famous, I thought every dude of the, you know, rock star of the 70s looked like Creedence Clearwater Revival. Like, they just all kind of
right.
looked like, right. you know, basic dudes, right. You know, and I right. think, watching this, you know, as a woman, you're kind of like, I get the sexuality mm-hmm. part of all of this. Like, the movie, it's one of those few moments where I tell people, if you ever wanted to watch a movie where the camera and the cameraman is clearly in love with everybody,
sure.
with the, you know, with sure. with Robert Plant especially, like, sure. the way he's filmed, sure. from everything is a low angle going up, like it's porn. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like, Michael Bay probably took notes. It was like, we'll do this with women. It'll
right,
be great.
Right,
but right. it really does, like, celebrate, like, look at how ridiculously attractive. I mean, the rest of the band.
Sure.
You sure. know, they're, you know, California fives. But, I mean, the rest of the movie, I think the cinematography really does, like, emphasize, like, these are rock gods.
Right.
These are, you know, men want to be them, women want to sleep with them, and I can't say that that's wrong,
right.
you know, because the movie, the cinematography really does prioritize that, and it's definitely something to watch as it just celebrates, like, the hotness of Robert Plant. It's offensive almost in certain scenes where I'm just like, stop making him hot. It's a problem here. You know, the man's wearing a girl t-shirt and some of the tightest pants known to man. I don't know how he's able to function. And I think that for me is the one of the elements of the concert footage is emphasizing, like, you're up close and personal.
Right.
Because a lot of
right.
concert footage too is usually from maybe like mid,
right.
you know, you get the
right.
proscenium arch.
Right.
So you see everything. And I definitely appreciate that. It was interesting to watch this after seeing The Moment, the Charlie XCX movie, which I think tries kind of similar to be like an anti-documentary, more, you know, I think it has more in common with this in terms of the self-indulgence than Spinal Tap, which is what it wanted.
Interesting.
But it just shows, I think, what makes this movie work so well is that it's self-indulgent, but I don't think anybody really realized
right.
that. You know,
right.
that was just them.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Mike, thoughts on the cinema of the concert, if you will.
I mean, I think some of those like upshots of Jimmy Page when he's doing the long solos and like the hair and everything, that's the closest I've come to a dude dripping sweat on me during sex.
Exactly. It's giving you the ultimate front row, right? Like the flop sweat is just like,
yeah.
On the camera screen.
But you mentioned also earlier, like, you know, I keep waiting for them to cut to Stonehenge. I would say that if they did, it might fucking work. Like, who else could you say that about? What other movie could you say that about? I mean, yes. At least half the audience would fucking yes. love it if they cut to Stonehenge, right?
They came out of the alien pods from Cap, you know, like... It would work. It would work. Fair. So, I mean, I know that Rob Reiner said he did not borrow from any specific band. That's a lie. Zeppelin. I will never not believe that.
Jason, in the notes, like, you're like, is it too long? You know what I mean? Are the solos too long? I'm sorry if I'm preempting you right now.
No, go ahead.
I noticed that in the notes earlier, and I really, like, it's I was question. Like, huh, started thinking about that. And I'm, you know, I you will very rarely even accede to the conversation of whether or not a movie is too long.
It's true.
I know that is, you have movies that you like, you have very, but when you think a movie's too long, you have very specific critiques about what, you know, sort of should have been removed, what didn't make sense, what was whatever. You have a very specific reason. You are never just like, this motherfucker just goes on for too long. Like, because you're here for the experience.
Absolutely.
And you're in for it. And, yeah. You know, for
and
most
to be
of the
clear,
time.
It's in the notes as a question. It's not a question that I have a definitive answer to.
Like, but it's not a question that you bring to hardly anything. So even I was sort of like, wow. And it's like, this: are the solos too long? Well, are you here to watch Jimmy Page play fucking guitar? Or do you have something else to do?
Yes.
I mean, like, this is one of those movies where it's like, if you're going to sit in for it, unless you're sitting down already not liking Robert Plant singing, well, then you're going to have a hard time finding your way into Song Remains the Same, right?
Totally.
But, like, if you can just sit and let the music rock you and give them just a little bit of grace to be too rich...
Yep.
For their own good when they were making this movie, and now he's going to climb the mountain and go be the guy in the fucking robe or whatever. If you can give them a little bit of grace for being too rich and a little too young with that much money and just let the music be the thing, then nothing here is too long. These guys know what they're doing, and they play the fuck out of it. And that's what most of it is.
Yeah,
we're going to get four individual Beatles movies. You know, at some point. That I feel is already too long.
That's already too
long. This, I'm like, give me another hour of Jimmy Page flop sweat and Robert Plant trying to squat, and I'm totally fine with this. I support this 100%.
Jason, you've really done a lot to get that idea into my head of like, are you here for the experience of this thing or not? And if your only complaint about it is that you vaguely feel like it was too long, then you just wanted to look at your fucking phone or something.
That's true. That's
you know
true.
What I mean? Like, but if you're like here for the experience of it,
right?
Then if it was too long, then there's specific. It's the way that you approach these things. I think is you've really won me over by sort of the way that you approach this question.
Right.
And this movie is a great example of sort of the way you approach these things. If you're in it for the experience, the experience is there for you.
Yeah. No, and to be fair, I think the main reason I was posing those questions was those were the questions or the criticisms that I had heard for 30 years that had kept me from kind of making seeing this movie a priority. My answer, I think, to both of those questions while I was watching it was, I don't know. And when you put it that way, when you put my shit back to me, I will say definitively, no, it's not too long. Because if what you went to this movie for was the same thing you went to this concert for, was to watch these guys play. And they play well, and they play long, and that's how they fucking play.
And when they cut away from them playing, you can still hear it.
Yes.
It's not like we have to go listen to them, you know, work out their monologues.
Yes, correct.
That they were trying to pitch, you know, correct. For whatever. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. They stick with the music. So that's what I mean. But give them a little bit of grace with the pictures.
There we
and
go.
Just let the song keep you, because the song will keep you. It's a 30-minute version of Dazed and Confused.
There we
How
go.
How is that possibly be interesting? But it's great.
I mean, let the man sing Whole Lot of Love for as long as he
long
wants.
As
the
long
song
as he
is going to be filthy no matter what, you know, whether it's 2 minutes or 10.
There you have
That's
it.
That's why you're there.
There you have it. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk about the movie's release and reception.
Are you a Smashburger king? Creating those crispy edges and the intense beefy flavor that puts fast food to shame? Thanks to Omaha Steaks, I never have to worry about whether I have high-quality proteins on hand. And they have so many options, handcrafted steaks, convenient comfort meals, and it's always excellent. Celebrate President's Day with the exceptional handcrafted flavor and convenience of Omaha Steaks. Get 50% off the world's best everyday protein. Go to omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their President's Day sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's 50% off at omahasteaks.com and an extra $35 off with promo code YUM at checkout. Go to https://omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide during their President's Day sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
This episode sponsored by Vita Hustle.
Why aren't you eating right? Because eating right is hard? Because it isn't. Kevin Hart fixed it 4 damn years ago with The One. The One is Vita Hustle's game-changing meal-replacing super shake, inspired by Kevin Hart's passionate belief that we all have the right to eat right. Kevin Hart is referring to himself in the third person because he's fired up. Because The One just passed 5 million super shakes sold. 5 million. Just a quick gut-healthy glass of The One gives you all the proteins, all the greens, and all the vitamins and more. One shake, no chaos. Listeners get 20% off their first purchase at VitaHustle.com. Go to VitaHustle.com. That's VitaHustle.com.
Here's something most people don't realize. Great sleep doesn't happen by accident. It starts with what you're sleeping on. That's why I switched to Sheik's. Their bedding is made from the same performance fabrics you'd find in elite athletic wear, but designed to help you sleep better. If you run hot at night, these sheets help you stay cool and dry. If you love that cozy, ridiculously soft feel, they've got that too. Comfort that stays consistent from the moment you hop into bed. And for anyone with an adjustable base, this is a game changer. Their Stay Fit corners are the best I've ever tried. No slipping, no popping off, even when the bed moves. When your days are demanding, Sheik's helps you wake up restored, not run down. Try them for yourself with their 60-night risk-free guarantee. Upgrade your sleep at Sheiks.com.
Friends, let's talk about the release and reception of The Song Remains the Same, which opened at New York Cinema One on Wednesday, October 20th, 1976. Also opening that day, Alan Parker's Bugsy Malone, Mel Brooks' silent movie, the neo-noir thriller Diary of the Dead, not to be confused with the late Romero movie, and MGM re-release of 2001 A Space Odyssey. Speaking of Kubrick, well done, Michael. And
what a hodgepodge of films.
And a double feature re-release of two of United Artists' biggest comedy hits of the previous year, The Sunshine Boys and The Return of the Pink Panther. Also playing in New York on that day, Marathon Man, Car Wash, The Ritz, Barry Lyndon, The Front, The 7% Solution, Deadly Hero, Cousin Cousine, Small Change, Solaris, Black Emmanuel, Linda Lovelace for President. These were all advertised in the New York Times in 1976, by the way, along with, I think we can agree, this should have been Best Picture of 1976, the opening of Misty Beethoven. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
There was a big election a few weeks away in October of 1976, and one of the people running was Harry Byrd Jr., a sitting senator from Virginia who inherited the seat from his dad 10 years before, even though that's not how our government works, and an appointment by the governor of Virginia because his father was the most powerful politician in Virginia. So when he passed, his kid got the seat. He had run a couple of times since then. He'd been reelected. This time, he was running again in Virginia, but for the first time, he was not running as a Democrat, which the New York Times summed up with this nifty little graph. The conflict and change referred to by Mr. Sweeney have so blurred party lines in Virginia that Harry Byrd Jr., though he looks, talks, and votes like his father, has abandoned the Democratic Party and become an independent in order to remain true to the old political philosophy. I'll let you figure out what that old political
that is some connotative speech right there. That is some fancy word salad for wanted to stay racist. That's what I'm assuming the subtext is there. No.
And now we don't even need subtext anymore.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
You can just say
exactly.
It now. It doesn't really even matter.
Sure could.
Times has been practicing this kind of like, you know, nice guy cleanup of sure. Yeah, anyway. Okay, so sure. that was happening 50 fucking years ago. They also printed the schedule for the UN and how to get tickets for tours that ran from 9 a.m. to 5:45 to 4:45 p.m. And that's not really what we think of as news. And I love it when I see things like that printed in the paper of record.
Yep.
You know, you want to tour the UN, you can go on down there. Finally, and most importantly, on Wednesday, October 20th, 1976, Argentine god of the pitch, Diego Maradona, made his professional debut at 15 years of age, 10 days before his 16th birthday. All right. How old are you, Jason? Have you even made your professional debut yet?
Wow.
Look at this guy. Eternal praise and reverence for the god King Diego Maradona on anything I participate in. That's headlines. Jason, what did critics say about the song Remains the Same?
Well,
he changed soccer forever.
Okay.
It was a very important day.
I'm happy for both of you. The certainly lower string New York Times critic Richard Eder wrote, quote, "The song Remains the Same is a movie to listen to Led Zeppelin by if you want to listen to Led Zeppelin. If you don't, there's no point going. If you do, it's still a dubious proposition." However, he concluded, and this is where he got me, "For the first two thirds, which was all this reviewer stayed, there seemed to be no other particular threat to the future adults in a stone-deaf civilization." Which was all this reviewer stayed? I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Richard Eder of the New York Times. You just noped out two-thirds of the way through the movie and then wrote the review anyway? Okay. And got paid well. Like, they were paying film critics really good in 76, I'll bet. Okay. In the Boston Globe, Ernie Santuoso opined, quote, "With the exception of sequences superimposed in an effort to avert boredom on the part of the audience, the motion picture was, again, a 35mm Diary of a Rock Concert. If nothing more, such films only confirm the adage that being there is twice the fun. The fantasy sequences seem to be leftovers from a past Neil Young epic and were just as dull as the original." End quote. The Detroit Free Press's Carl Arrington was slightly kinder, but warned, "Thanks to a special sound system set up in theaters showing the movie, the sound is as important as the screen image. The reproduction of the Zeppelin sound of bluesy hard rock is delivered with sometimes excruciating accuracy. The audience is pulverized by the sound, the same way the geeks were riddled with bullets in the opening. If you are a Zepp freak, and judging from their album sales and early attendance figures, there are plenty of you, that is just fine. But if your taste leans towards soft rock or soul, the endless riffing of Jimmy Page and the intense shrieks of Robert Plant are likely to drive you out for popcorn more than once. The title doth not lie. For most of the movie, the song remains the same, or so it seems." End quote. Again, like
this,
two...
After listening to these, this is the best concert movie ever. This is ridiculous. I'm all in on this movie after listening to these fucking stuffy people.
I think the question becomes then, kind of what we, Jason, like you and I would discuss, like, does one have to be a music critic in a sense,
right,
you know, or have an awareness of music in order to review this movie accurately? You know, you can certainly talk about the movie as a movie, how it's edited, how the sound mix is, but I think that for somebody to not do the bare modicum of research, like, the biggest complaint I think people... those reviews have is that, like, Zeppelin sucks. And you're like, right.
I don't like Robert Plant.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're like,
who do you think you're warning this movie away from? Like,
yeah, like you should do your research. They're like one of the biggest bands in the world. You know, sure, a line about how if you don't like Zeppelin, then you're probably going to be in hell. But to say that the movie is bad because Zeppelin sucks and you're not a fan, like, that's not judging the movie on any merit, you know, at that point.
Right. And I would say that, you know, like, if your taste leans towards soft rock or soul, well, if your taste leans toward that, you're probably not going to go see Led Zeppelin, The Song Remains the Same. Like, who is that review for? Okay, finally, New York Daily News' Kathleen Carroll, in a brief review, gave it 0 out of 4 stars, calling it, quote, a hopelessly pretentious piece of trash featuring the British rock group The Led Zeppelin in what is laughably called a performance. She continued, it is cluttered with meaningless shots of machine gun toting gangsters, flaming swords, fluttering doves, and riders on horseback. That, plus the constant screeching of Zeppelin's bare-chested, scraggly-haired lead singer Robert Plant, makes this a film that will be tolerated only by tone-deaf teenagers, end quote. So, like, that's a review that's really, like, hitting, checking all the boxes in terms of, like, newspaper critic snobbery. It's like, oh, tone-deaf teenagers.
That's the shit sandwich review of the of all of the reviews for another Spinal Tap reference. It's just I think the thing that I'm gravitating towards is everybody in unison is like Robert Plant's shrieking. Hey, like his range is bananas. Okay, it's crazy. I don't hear y'all like 30 years later saying like Jeff Buckley shrieking. I don't know. What are you guys listening to? Because he's doing the exact same thing on the album that he's doing here. It's not, and it's in tune. Like I don't know. I've heard far worse people try to sing as one of the big like anti La La Landers. Like I don't know. You know, Emma Stone's not a strong singer. But, like, Jesus, I wouldn't be going on and on about, like, she sounds like a dying cat.
The idea, I have a lot, I have criticisms of this movie. Robert Plant can't sing is, like, definitely not one of them. It's kind of a cuckoo bananas hill to die on.
I think a lot of times film critics and film people don't want to sort of to say out loud that somebody can just like watch this guy's cock pocket for 2 hours and be totally entertained, because like we sort of need for things for audiences to need more than that. Or else what are we here for? Or is that mean that I have to, you know what I mean? Like it's like people aren't, won't, that's a short review, but like really like, I'd like to see Kathleen Carroll get up and read her reviews for 2 hours and 17 minutes and remain interesting the entire time. I think that like the idea that, you know, that sort of laughably called a performance. Like what? Like no, I don't even, that's not even, it was recorded on celluloid. It's clearly a movie. It's such a weird thing to say. They're at Madison Square Garden for two fucking hours. What do you mean call laugh? You lose credibility with me at that point.
Sure.
It goes back to another movie that I think also sparked a generation that also has questionable full frontal shots from their lead actor. But, I remember when Labyrinth came out, you know, another seminal piece of ephemera for me as a young
formative work, I'm sure.
You know, and to hear somebody say like, oh, well, David Bowie can't sing, you know, and like, he's also a really bad actor. You're like, that's the bare monicum of problems. Okay. With that. Like, I think critics now, you know, and I wonder how much of a thing this is, if it was a thing at all. I feel like now modern day critics, we're far more in tune with an audience, you know, and understanding like who our reader is. You know, and I think reading a lot of some of those old reviews from movies from the 70s, the 60s, when newspapers were predominant, the idea of being a film critic was something that, you know, you had to be like a snooty falooty educated person in order. But they're writing to a readership that is usually skewing far older than them. And sometimes you can feel that. And I feel that a lot 100%. With these reviews. If I were to review this movie today, I'd be like, right. My audience is going to be comprised of who knows how many ages of people, you know, right. Like I have exactly. to look at it in total as opposed to just right. the segment of people. This is why diversity in film criticism is important, because you don't want stodgy white people writing their reviews correct. For other stodgy white people.
Correct. Well said. Correct. All right, Mike, how did it do in terms of box office and awards?
Well, it did just fine commercially, grossing $200,000 in its opening week and going on to gross $12 million by 1990, and has continued to do well at midnight screenings and on home video. The 2-LP soundtrack album, also a big hit, going 4X platinum with 2 million copies sold in its initial release. They didn't need to make money off the movie. They sold 4 million copies of a 2-LP set.
Yeah.
That more than paid for the yeah. shot of him climbing up a fake mountain. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, you know them
alas,
shit sold
no
at a...
Oscars.
You know them shit sold at a premium price point, too. You know that was like a 1999 yeah, record.
Come on. Yeah, they did fine.
Yeah.
This movie did great on vinyl.
Yes.
Alas, no Oscars or other awards of note for the boys.
Ah, well. Well, now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Kristen, you're our guest, which means you go first.
Oh, gosh. I mean, the obvious, I'm going to steal the obvious one from everybody, which okay. is Spinal Tap.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. It's just too...
If you've literally done this double feature, then you should definitely talk about it for Double It Up.
I mean, it just, it makes so much sense. And A, we should always be watching Rob Reiner movies.
Of course.
You know, especially
of
now.
Of course.
But I think that the fact that Spinal Tap is clearly sending up movies like this, you know, it's clearly... Right. poking fun at, you know, less the indulgence of like the we're gonna make our own movies, but more the indulgence of like being a rock band that thinks that, you know, you're awesome. Although Spinal Tap is chasing trends and thinks they're fantastic and they're not,
right.
and you know, Robert right. Plant definitely thinks he's awesome and he is.
Right.
So yeah, that's the one right. I the obvious choice. You know, it's either that or Almost Famous if you want like the parallels. So yeah,
that's a good one too. That's a good one too.
Yeah.
Mine, forgive the incoming blue language. But my pick is Robert Frank's Cocksucker Blues, which is his chronicle of the Rolling Stones on tour, circa, I want to say 71, 72. A movie that is famously, illegal to see. He made a Robert Frank movie, and it turned out that the Stones, or at least their management, did not care for that particular presentation of the group. So they buried the movie. They never released it. You can only see it with Robert Frank present, or on bootlegs, which are not that hard to find. And I think it's just a fascinating article in terms of, like, it is sort of the flip side of a movie like The Song Remains the Same. It is a movie about how there could be nothing more dull and depressing than being a world famous rock star. And it's extremely voyeuristic. It's extremely verite. It is really more about sort of the hangers on, the groupies, the roadies, the sort of mirthless bacchanal that surrounds a Rolling Stones tour, not really so much about the Stones themselves, who are sort of supporting players in it. I really the thing that you said earlier, Kristen, about the you know, grappling with the idea of this being sort of an anti-documentary, I think Cocksucker Blues like is definitely an anti-documentary, an anti-concert movie, and watching them these two movies in conversation with each other, I think would be really compelling. Mike, what about you?
Well, I had never thought about Kubrick as a way to improve this movie, and I think that's correct, but he could have improved for virtually anything, so that's not really that interesting.
Sure.
The only other way you could have improved this movie is if they would have met the people that made Heavy Metal before they went out and started filming, because if you made the Heavy Metal, you know, you do where you were like you let it just be a whole Aleister Crowley buying the Stairway to Heaven, the whole thing, you know what I mean, where like you actually turn it into a cohesive, coherent narrative,
And the whole thing looks like looks like the art on the side of a van. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. Right. Could have been super cool, I think. So yeah, yes. I would say heavy metal.
Go with that. All right, Kristen, where can people follow you on social media and read your work?
Yeah, I am all over the internet. You can find me on all social media at Kristen K. Lopez, unless it's Instagram, because I couldn't get that handle, at Kristen Lopez 88.
How dare they?
I'm predominantly at the Film Maven, at thefilmmaven.com, where if we're talking about rock, I just interviewed Penelope Spheeris. We talked about Black Sheep.
Nice.
But we also talked about all sorts of things. Oh, yeah, it was definitely a fun day for me.
Love that.
And I do a subscriber model. So if you like my work, please consider getting a paid subscription. I do a lot of fun, in-depth work over there. And then my podcast, Ticklish Business, is wherever you get your podcasts. We also have a YouTube channel that I'm working on actually using. And we have a Patreon at patreon.com/ticklishbiz if you want to support that.
There we go. I'm Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
Follow Guide for the Film Fanatic on Instagram. Where we, I guess if you already listened to the show, do you need to follow it on Instagram?
No, you can.
I hadn't thought about that. It seemed like an obvious thing to do, but it's just clips from the show.
Right.
Previews.
There you clips. Go. There you have it.
Clips. All right. Michael Hull on Letterboxd.
Still enjoying your Letterboxd experience?
Oh, it's the best. It's the best social media because nobody cares about anything but movies. So it's
there you
the
go.
One, like literally, if somebody shot the president, and I don't mean the current president, I mean any president ever.
Sure.
You could be on Letterboxd for 2 days and not find out about
not
it.
Not know
it's
about it.
Fantastic.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, please do leave us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get our weekly show notes and such, you can do all that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us in the show, feel free at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And of course, if you're one of the weirdos who likes to watch, hello, videos of people recording a podcast, hi, you'll find us on YouTube on our channel, Guide for the Film Fanatic.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic. And shout out to executive producer Blake Howard. You know, I asked him if he'd mind if maybe we sold some merch for the show, and it was the weirdest thing. He threw a chair and said, it doesn't matter. So long as there's an extra nickel to be drained by exploiting Guide for the Film Fanatic, it's great.
Thank you again, Kristen.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. On the next Guide for the Film Fanatic, Rolling Stone's David Fear joins us to discuss Mel Brooks' comedy classic, Young Frankenstein. See you then.
Here's something most people don't realize. Great sleep doesn't happen by accident. It starts with what you're sleeping on. That's why I switched to Sheiks. Their bedding is made from the same performance fabrics you'd find in elite athletic wear, but designed to help you sleep better. If you run hot at night, these sheets help you stay cool and dry. If you love that cozy, ridiculously soft feel, they've got that too. Comfort that stays consistent from the moment you hop into bed. And for anyone with an adjustable base, this is a game changer. Their Stay Fit corners are the best I've ever tried. No slipping, no popping off, even when the bed moves. When your days are demanding, Sheiks helps you wake up restored, not run down. Try them for yourself with their 60-night risk-free guarantee. Upgrade your sleep at Sheiks.com.